Welcome to a new episode of The Brand Called You. Today I have a good friend, Pradeep Puri, a senior bureaucrat, a well-known professional who's come to talk to us. Pradeep, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ashutosh.
Pradeep is a BA and an MA from Delhi University. He joined the IAS in 1979 for 17 years. Then he was with ILNFS for 20 years. And now he has his own company, KATP Advisors. Pradeep, talk to us a little bit about your time with the government. First, why did you choose to join the IAS?
Interesting question, Ashutosh. When I was young, I don't consider myself very old now, but when I was young, the career choices in the late 70s are fairly limited. Yeah. You either joined the government or the army, or the private sector was in a relative infancy even then. And I come from a family of bureaucrats. My father, my brother, my sister-in-law, first cousin, uncle, all been very senior bureaucrats. So it was a kind of a natural progression. One didn't really question or have too many career choices. Yeah. So, you know, one seamlessly did university 5 years, Delhi University, and just wrote the UPSC exam, and then you joined. I mean, that probably sounds simple in retrospect.
I was going to say, it wasn't that easy.
But to be honest, the kind of career choices children today, youngsters, are, you know, and I envy them for that. It's enormous. It was fairly straight-laced in our time, you know, army, private sector, law. Law was not that popular at that point in time. Mm. And if you were doing reasonably well in academics, liberal background, history at university, then I think there was a natural progression, you know. Maybe after reaching and joining the IAS, you asked yourself, this is where I really wanted to be or not, you know, but it was, you know, something which happened as a natural progression.
And any interesting highlights from your IAS career?
Oh, huge. I mean, I spent about almost 18, 19 years. And I think the most important highlight for me was we were there that period early 1991. In fact, I was in Delhi, the finance ministry, when we were going through a fairly serious economic crisis. Okay. And we saw this transition or transformation from a license raj closed regime with huge entry barriers into what the beginnings of what we are today. This was in 91 and Dr. Manmohan Singh was the finance minister. And I remember these two devaluations which took place, I think within 2 or 3 days of each other. And, you know, suddenly you woke up one day and realized that, you know, license raj is gone. 6 months or 1 year back, Coca-Cola had been there and then Coca-Cola had been asked to
leave or assume
a different format or something that became Campa Cola. I mean, I think youngsters today would probably have difficulty in even, figuring out what I'm saying.
Correct.
But those were the days. Yeah. Those were days when, you know, if you wanted to go out in Delhi and have a drink, if you were an Indian, you couldn't really drink in a bar. I remember there was a hotel somewhere in Daryaganj. We went there for what ostensibly was beer, my brother and some of his friends. And they brought this teapot and teacups, and they poured the beer in the teacups, and we drank. Now, this was India and Delhi, late 70s, mid 70s. That's a transformation which has taken place. And, you know, when you watch TV, you had black and white TV until the Asian Games or whatever it was in 1980. And it was only one camera, and if the test match was in your city, you could watch it in black and white. If the test match was in Mumbai, well, you know, you really didn't go get a picture for that.
That is so true. And, so coming to your 1991, you know, I remember I used to be in Singapore in 1991 and I was part of Mr. Narasimha Rao, Mr. Manmohan Singh, Dr. Manmohan Singh and Mr. Chidambaram's delegation.
Right.
And those were very heady days, you know, and that was one of the reasons I decided to come back to India. You lived it.
Right.
What were some of your experiences in that 91 to 96 period?
To be honest, I was a fairly young junior bureaucrat, but privileged to be watching this on the sidelines.
Correct.
And to be honest, at the point at which much of this was happening, it was fairly incomprehensible, mm-hmm. but the enormity of it came much later. The understanding, you know, the fact that we were making initial movements towards capital account convertibility, there was so much conservation of foreign exchange, you know, everything was in terms of an entry barrier. And the realization then that what was happening in East Asia, that script had been written by Indian economists 20 years before. And why we never read our own economists, and we took 20, 30 years
yeah.
back on that journey. For example, if you look at Korea, their steel production in 1960 was lower than India. Mm. And Korea is one of the highest steel producers in the world. Mm. And what China began in 1979, yeah. virtually 79,
yeah.
we started the first infant steps in 1991 virtually.
Correct.
And I was privileged to be there watching this on the sidelines,
right.
Ringside seat, but I wouldn't really, I mean, be exaggeration to say that I was part of it. I was watching it closely.
No, I understand. I mean, I remember I used to send a daily telex from Singapore to the Commerce Secretary, Mr. Khanna.
Right.
And he used to, I met him a few times, and he'd say, I want a daily update. And I used to actually say, wow, look at this bureaucrat. Mm. He wants to be so connected. But, you know, there has generally been a belief that bureaucrats or bureaucracy
mm-hmm.
has slowed down India.
I wouldn't disagree with that.
What is your view then?
Ashutosh, I wouldn't disagree with that. I think, you know, of course, anything I think say is highly subjective and
yeah.
from a personal point of view. But my belief is the skill set which is required in government or from an administrative point of view in the 50s, 60s, 70s was fairly limited. And the academy in Missouri, I'm talking about the IAS,
yeah. Yeah.
could impart the necessary skills. But come what is today a digital revolution, as it were, an information revolution which is happening, I don't think we have the adequate skill sets. We understand. And therefore, we need to let go of much more. There's still far too much discretion which still lies in the bureaucratic process. In all fairness, there's the other side of the story that, you know, if you had completely unfettered competition, makes sense where, you know, per capita incomes have reached a certain level, where you have huge inequalities, huge differences in opportunity. In a situation like that, perhaps you can't really use a Singaporean touch of a light touch, you know, you need the state. Unless there was state intervention. These are philosophical arguments.
Mm-hmm.
But coming back to your point of view, I think what is required of a bureaucrat today is so different from 1949
Correct.
Or 1960.
Absolutely.
But yet the training module, I suspect, had not moved apace. But again, I would not disagree with your, I think, basic premise that you were being polite. The bureaucracy has slowed things down. This is a natural tendency when I'm confronted with something which is slightly different or alien. Really, the response is not always positive, or it's not creative or proactive. You tend to, you know, ask questions. And I think, and this debate is already apace, and the Prime Minister has said so, they talk about lateral entry. I don't think it's a question of getting 50 or 100 guys laterally. It's trying to realize that there are areas in which the bureaucracy is extremely strong, in terms of, let's say, we do this election so successfully okay. every 5 years or so. There are other areas where you must admit that our performance has been hugely suboptimal. Take health and education. You take most health indices, and as an Indian, I feel
yeah.
almost ashamed to say so, we are below sub-Saharan Africa. You take infant mortality, you virtually take any basic indices, the WHO. Why so? Why should Bangladesh and Nepal have better indices in terms
Correct.
Of basic health care?
Correct. Correct.
Or even availability of teachers per thousand of population or access to, you know, basic primary health. It's not that the state has not been spending in India. State spend is fairly large.
A lot of money, yeah.
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 But somehow the results have not been where they should have been. Things are changing rapidly. So I think in certain areas we
yeah.
need to rethink where the role of the state and where we let non-state aid actors come in a more powerful sense.
Mm. And as now someone who has been a bureaucrat and has been a professional manager in some exciting areas, and we'll talk a little bit about that. What are your thoughts on a China versus India perspective? You know, one is a $12-13 trillion economy, one is a $3 trillion economy, moving fast. What do you think our bureaucrats are doing well, or our politicians are not doing well, that the Chinese are doing? And one, of course, common factor is that, you know, in China, they can take any decision they want. Here, there's too much second guess it.
Ashwin, I'll give you a simple statistic, which I think to my mind addresses the whole India-China issue. The entire luxury car market in India is 30,000 units. That is your Mercedes, your Audis, your BMWs, your Jaguars sell 30,000 units a year in India. In China, Mercedes alone sells 6 lakh units.
Wow.
6 lakh units. How many jobs are each luxury car? Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. Are you seriously telling me that 6 lakh Indians cannot afford a Mercedes Benz? I don't buy it. I think what we have managed to do very successfully is create barriers to growth. And we have become entrenched or completely wedded to those silos, not understanding. We'll take simple, I mean, I read a statistic the other day that almost, 50-55% of GDP is domestic consumption. In the US, it's way higher. Take the average Indian household. The cost of the fast-moving consumer good or white good in relation to his salary vis-a-vis what it is, let's say, in East Asia. I'm not talking about OECD. Now, you have a duty structure. If I'm not mistaken, almost 50% used to be. Now, you have GST. Or the cost of a car was duties. Now, if you were, it's like the, when the mobile phone first came, my first mobile phone, I think, was, I got one in 1997. It weighed about 3 kilos.
Yeah.
It was 18,000 rupees.
Correct.
And I was a proud guy in my office, but I couldn't carry it. It was so heavy. Today, you get a smartphone virtually 1,000 rupees. Similarly, if you rationalize, I mean, it's very easy for us to sit here and talk. There are issues in terms of resource mobilization, the spend the state needs to do for education, health. But if you could expand the market in terms of lowering entry barriers in terms of cost, why is it that every time you travel to Bangkok and you come on the return flight, you see every passenger carrying a TV? Who are we benefiting from our excise duty structure? The high taxpayer. You're buying there, you're paying a minimal duty here. This is, I mean, there are examples like this which, you know, you can multiply. But essentially, you need to come down to a lower cost economy. Very easy for you and I sit here to say that. Where you have much more access, because one, something which I fear personally is that, you know, we're looking at the GDP growth numbers, we've gone to 7, 7.5, 6%. You probably are heading for a middle income trap, where the first 100 million have satiated themselves in terms of the one or two cars or one air conditioner they have to buy. And the second 100 million, you're not really able to capture that. So growth is really going to taper off. Because there are numerous other issues in terms of what's happening in the GDP and the economy. But really, we need to move away from a duty structure which is contributing almost 50% to the cost of the product. I mean, if I may jump the gun, talk about an issue like water. You take urban water, actually the rates we spend in this country, the cost per unit, or kiloliter as they call it, is much higher than most parts of East Asia. And our water availability is lower. Our non-revenue water losses are 40 to 60%. That means you get 100 liters, you supply, you get paid for 40 liters. 60 liters goes either as wastage or it's theft. Therefore, the cost of that 1 kiloliter given to Ashutosh is higher than parts of Bangkok. So you're really trapping our consumer into a high-cost situation where if you had larger volumes in terms of availability, the cost would go down, efficiency would go up. And I suspect that's happening to a large part. Things have changed enormously, to be honest. But I think we still have some way to go.
Have some work to do. I agree. Because, you know, this whole thing of prices being high, consumption being low, Indian consumer not spending is something we have known for a long time. And successive governments don't seem to address it.
Well, this brings me back to that bureaucratic syndrome. You have a certain tax base, which is based on, let's say, a 28% GST across the board. If you were to reduce that GST rate, you think the rates would your tax revenue would plummet, you couldn't pay salary tomorrow. But I think you need a calibrated manner. It cannot happen overnight. But I find the GST rates in 5 levels is
high.
It was never meant to be high. And it's way too high. You need to make sure that the post-GST, I mean, you have a revenue neutral rate. That means you fix your GST at a rate where if you did not have GST, you have the same revenue. That's not the intention. intention was that you would have a rate where you would have a 1.5 or a 2x multiplier eventually.
Correct.
Because of leakages and this becomes a seamless system.
Yeah.
But that apparently has not been happening. I suspect, I mean, I'm not far from being a tax expert, but rates are still far too high.
Still too high. And therefore, encouraging people to still underdeclare.
Two things. Underdeclaration is relatively difficult now.
Yeah.
But the formalities are still far too rigid. It can be simplified. I mean, but, you know, we need to move away from that British Raj thing that, you know, we don't trust the natives.
Mm.
And that is not fully gone.
Correct.
I mean, I know people, you lived in Singapore, where you ring up and say this tax is thing, you get a refund. Oh,
yeah.
By the time you put the phone down, the refund has been in your account because they checked it. There's no issue. We trust
you.
And if you're misled, you will then pay a penalty. So it's an open system with very severe penalties.
Correct.
Whereas we have a relatively rigid system where the penalties, I mean, I haven't heard of anybody going to prison in this country for tax evasion.
Mm.
When you heard of Sophia Loren and Steffi Graf's father many, many years ago.
Oh, yeah.
So have an open system with very severe penalties.
I agree.
But then again, our DNA being what it is, I think we can't completely adapt what happens in other parts of the world.
So moving on, you know, after a successful innings in the IAS, you decided to move to ILNFS. What made you take a call? I mean, you know, you could have been sitting as Secretary, Government of India, wielding so much power.
I'm not sure, I mean, where I've been sitting on. I think this was a time, the early 90s, of, you know, 91, when this transformation was taking place. Opportunities were opening up.
Correct.
And the difference, you know, at that point of time, if you looked at, let's say, mid-90s, late-90s, the chairman of Hindustan Lever would drive the same Maruti 800 as, let's say, a secretary to government.
Correct.
And they'd just come out of the ambassador car or the Fiat car, which was a waiting period at some point in time of 8 or 10 years to get a car. I mean, if you have the money, you could get the car.
If you were lucky.
Yeah, if you were lucky. I mean, I remember our first scooter, my brother got the scooter, and he got it because my mother's elder brother was a general in the army and had the army quota. And I don't know if this is typically legitimate or not, he got his Lambretta scooter. My brother used to 5 years in university. And when he passed out, I inherited his Lambretta scooter. But to get that scooter took us years and years.
I was going to tell you that I got my first scooter when an uncle of mine sent $500.
Okay.
And I got a Bajaj Chetak.
Oh, that was it. We got a Lambretta, which was in the family for many years.
Yeah.
But the point was the opportunities were opening up.
Correct.
And I said, you know, frankly, I mean, I must acknowledge my entire family, which is bureaucrats and very senior bureaucrats at that, were highly supportive of the move. But we saw opportunities opening out. And I was excited about the fact that associated creating something world class, which I think the Delhi Noida project was at one point of time.
Yeah.
Subsequent developments I don't want to go into, but it was, you know, you were getting involved in infrastructure creation, which was and still is a very great requirement in this country. So I think I got turned on by that. I left relatively early without even getting my pension, about 18 and a half years or so. A lot of people said I'm foolhardy. A lot of people still say I'm foolhardy, but you know, we all have our own preferences, but I have no regrets about the journey.
And you spent time in two businesses. One was you built this beautiful Noida Road, and the second you spent a lot of time in water.
Right.
What were your experiences like in now sitting as a professional and dealing with bureaucrats?
I wish it could say pleasant. I mean, they were very nice periods also. But I think I do want to simplify the conversation into the bureaucrats were difficult, hence it was frustrating.
No,
they were mirroring the value system in that society. And I think one thing I've come to recognize from my experience in private sector and infrastructure is that, you know, there are certain models which work universally, which probably are not the most appropriate for India.
Yeah.
I'll give you a clear example. I don't think as a society or as a economy, we're very comfortable with the privatization or appropriation of gain from a public utility, to put it bluntly. And I'll give you an example of this. When we were doing Delhi Noida, there was a flyover ashram which we built at something like 12 or 13 crores, or probably less. That was a landed cost. Similarly, there were flyovers of approximately the same physical configuration, 300 meter length, built in other parts in Delhi, in the NCR region, at a cost of 90 or 100 crores.
Wow.
Eventually, there were questions that were asked, but there were built and went. The point I'm trying to make is, we need to be very careful in terms of letting the private sector do and not encroach upon the domain which is better dealt with by the state. So, if you ask me going ahead, you haven't asked me the question, but in any case, I share my 2 bits of experience with you. When it comes to capital investment, leave it to the state or state agencies. Because if there's any gain there, let it lie with the state. And let the private sector come into the O&M, the maintenance, the actual running of the asset, right, which the state is not very good at.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example of Delhi Noida, which I mean, they're not spending any money, but they must have done about 350, 400 million vehicles in the last so many years, and there's been one overlay.
Yeah.
In Delhi, most PWD roads, you overlay once a year. So let the maintenance be with the private sector. If you're looking at the private sector to make capital investment, it can work, but then I think the ground reality has to be different. But one lesson, as it were, or which I think I'll share to you, which really we need to wake up to as a nation and society, is not just the rule of law, the sanctity of contract. If you do not respect contract, prospective investors are not going to come.
Correct.
They're going to go. It's happening all the time. Yeah. It happened in Delhi Noida. It's happening in parts of South India. I don't want to mention the state. But you need to have to respect the contract. You don't like the contract, renegotiate it. Nothing prevents you from renegotiating. But you can't just wish away a contract because it's inconvenient. And I understand that if I can look the other way, the consequences going ahead are fairly serious.
Interesting. Interesting. And then, decided to become a coach when you decided to step down. What made you move towards coaching?
Well, actually, I'm not only looking at executive coaching, I'm also doing a little NGO on the side. I'm doing a little startup also. But coaching, I think, is very interesting because I think all of us who spend 30, 40 years in a career are dealing with people all the time. And we all have our own little stories.
Yeah.
And I think coaching is an opportunity of sharing. In the sense, you're sharing your experience, which may or may not do good to anyone, to the coachee. But I think you have a lot to give back in the sense that where somebody can benefit from your mistakes, maybe your success, but certainly can benefit and not make the same mistakes you made. And in a 40-year journey, you've made a lot. I've made a lot of mistakes.
Yeah, I'm going to come to that question.
I've made a lot of mistakes. So I think coaching is, I enjoy it, though it's extremely frustrating. It's very time-consuming. It takes up virtually all your bandwidth. There's very little time or energy or emotion for anything else. But I enjoy coaching. Because you really, it's a life partnership. And you're seeing the results of that partnership it's very intimate in a sense.
Yeah, I agree.
So I enjoy coaching, but I don't do too much of it.
You spoke of an NGO and a startup. What are these?
The NGO, in fact, is an interesting story. My elder daughter, she was working in the US. She had got laid off. This was in 2008. She'd gone to Wharton, done an undergrad degree. She got laid off and came back and worked with multinational in Mumbai for about 1 or 2 years. And then she, I think, had the possibility of extending that contract by another year. When I said to her, whether you have 1 or 2 years, you ultimately want to go back and do an MBA and get back into a international corporate kind of culture again. So why don't you look at an NGO? So she came upon this NGO called St. Jude. Basically, they provide holistic care for children from underprivileged backgrounds suffering from cancer.
Okay.
We provide a shelter, etc. So my daughter Alia worked for St. Jude. And when she was leaving, she introduced me to the founder, Nihal Kaviratnam. And Nihal made the statement, normally children follow in their parents' footsteps. But here the father is following in the daughter's footsteps.
Wonderful.
Which is exactly what happens.
So that should make you feel very proud.
I enjoyed. So we now got 4 centers in Noida, which is about 42 units. This thing. We have all in Japan and their presence. And I was quite involved in setting this up from scratch in 2012 to 13 was 1 year background, and it's been functioning 2013. So that keeps me, I wouldn't say fully busy, but it takes up a little bit of my time, not too much. The startups, in fact, are 2 or 3, basically in areas of technology, not IT, technology, where we're trying to adapt technologies which are developed in the West, probably abandoned in the West, in terms of usages in India. it's still at an infancy. I don't know whether you're going to succeed or not. Mm-hmm. We're butting our heads against the wall trying to get the technology agreements. Sure. But the work will be really interesting.
Sure, very interesting. So moving now to a few questions on Pradeep Puri as an individual. First question is, when was the last time you did something for the first time?
When was the last time I did something for the first time? Every time you do something which is not a routine repetition, you're doing it for the first time. And you reassess the situation. I mean, I played golf this morning. Okay. And the shots at work were, I looked at the ball and not tried to repeat the shot of the previous hole. So you really are starting afresh every time. Okay. And if you forget that, you get into a rut and I think it's suboptimal. And more important, you don't enjoy what you're doing.
Second question would be, you know, you and I have often spoken. Given today's health standards and everything, most of us, post 60, will at least live for 30, 35 years. You know, we'll have good health, and you know, unless there's a calamity or something, but we'll live. Which means that our so-called life post 60 will be almost equal to our working life. This is another perspective. You have transitioned well and you're doing so many different things. And yet, I'm sure you know, I know several people who don't plan at all. Mm-hmm. What are some of your thoughts on second innings?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I didn't realize the fact that what you said is absolutely correct, that your post-retirement life is almost equivalent. 30 years, I think, would be generous, but even if it's 20, 25 years, to your working career. And we very few of us plan for it. I know you've written some books and you're gracious enough to present some of them to me. I actually see a bit of a dichotomy between my colleagues in the bureaucracy, who I think handle it less well than my friends in the private sector, for reasons I can't really comprehend, because either in the bureaucracy it's so regimented, stratified, things are done for you in the sense that you have a support staff, and suddenly when that's not available, if you've not planned for it, you are at a bit of a loss.
Correct.
And you have innate talents and strengths and a passion which somehow gets bottled up in a shock that this is gone and now I'm just there till the good Lord calls me away.
Yeah.
I've seen this in so many of my friends in the IAS. They're not being very good at coping with it. Mm. Despite the health being good. And then this reinforces the downward slide in terms of health and your mental well-being. But most of my private sector friends, I find they're in a much better position to handle it. Mm-hmm. Either because they have changed jobs every 3 to 5 years. Here you had somebody who's been for 40 years doing a regulated structure. It's a regulated, like in the army.
Yeah.
And it's you first lieutenant, second lieutenant, captain, major. And it's all fairly smooth stairway upwards. Whereas in the corporate sector, you would switch jobs. You probably are more autonomous in your thought processes, in a sense. I mean, so probably handle it better. But the point remains, you need to plan. It is not something you can do spontaneously. I mean, I'm discovering that. I'm doing things which I never thought I would be doing. I mean, I've been wanting to read the Mahabharata in English for a long time. I finally found 2 volumes of something by Ramesh Menon, which I find eminently readable. Now, I couldn't have seen myself doing this 1 year before I quit.
Absolutely.
This is something I want to do, and you know, just a frivolous example probably. But the fact that there is so much you want to do, which is not contingent on material well-being or health, reading for example, there's so much you want to read. Maybe you want to travel, which is not very expensive today. But let your passions come out. Let the passions then contour and you paint according to your next 5-10 years and whatever you want to do.
Right.
And put it very crudely, you know, the bucket list things you want to do. Bucket is not a very nice term, but literally there are passions you have within you. You still have the capacity when you're around because you have the health and maybe enough material well-being. Pursue those, whatever they are. Painting, traveling, reading, whatever. In my case, music.
Music, wonderful. So my last question to you. What are your learnings from some of your biggest failures?
I think the failures are very clear to identify. I think an over-enthusiasm, you take ownership of the issue as if it's your personal. It's not. It never is. Whether it's business or government, you need to detach yourself. If there is an agent trying to do a job, you're a CEO, and you have certain resources, and you can, there can be business failures, there can be genuine mistakes made. Mm-hmm. It's not your personal failure. I wish somebody had told me this at certain points in time. You need to distance yourself. Because what happens is, A, your objectivity goes because you become too emotional about the problem. And it's not my problem. I'm not even a shareholder of the company. I'm only the CEO. Yeah. But you assume it's your problem. Yeah. And then you go the extra yard to solve it.
Right.
Which I don't think is professionally very good. It's not good for your health. So basically learning to distance yourself from a situation, which when it becomes complex, listen more to other people also. You think you know it all, you never know it. I certainly didn't know it all.
Correct.
And I think some of the mistakes could have been not avoided, but at least the outcomes could have been more palatable. Mm-hmm. And I've been more objective and less emotional in terms of my involvement with the situation.
Yeah. Pradeep, thank you very much. Your words of wisdom will be heard by thousands of people. And I'm sure they'll get lots of interesting comments on when we put this out. So thank you again for coming.
Thank you, Pradeep. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You podcast. Be sure to visit tbcy.in to join the conversation, access show notes, and discover fantastic bonus content. You can follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Simply search for the Brand Called You. Thank you, and see you next week.